Today, cashless or clueless? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to Latest Post, covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Many won't be surprised to learn that card payments are more popular than ever, with Australians making over 8.3 billion card payments, or almost 23 million transactions each day. Almost 7 in 10 card payments were made with a debit card, and 4.9 million per day were using FPOS, not linked to a credit card scheme. And of course, Tap and Go has been around for years. New technology and payment companies are reducing the cost and the time required to move money, and online shopping is forecast to explode. In a recent paper, CBA forecasts that cash could disappear by 2022, replaced by electronic substitutes. So today, I want to consider the social impact of going digital and the problems associated with financial stability in a disaggregated digital payments world. Certainly, it appears that Australians are using cold hard cash less and less. In 2008, we used to go to the ATM 40 times per year on average, according to the RBA's figures. A decade later, it was down to 25 times and declining. Over roughly the same period, the number of card transactions grew by 5 times. But despite the predictions of becoming a cashless society by 2022, Australia is still flush with the stuff. In fact, the amount of cash in the Australian economy is near a 50-year per capita high, according to the RBA, and it's predominantly $50 and $100 bills that we're clinging on to. For every Australian, there are currently around 30 $50 and 14 $100 banknotes on issue, Philip Lowe explained at last year's payment summit. So there is an apparent paradox between the declining use of cash and the rising value of banknotes on issue. And in the UK, payments with cash have fallen from 60% in 2008 to 28% just 10 years later, according to the Bank of England. Yet, according to a recent BIS survey, of 66 central banks surveyed, they highlighted that cash-related challenges differ by central bank. Some central banks reported a high reliance on cash and are motivated by reducing costs and improving know your customer and countering the financing of terrorism arrangements. Other central banks have the opposite challenge, a low or declining use of cash for payments, which motivates research into a central bank digital currency that would maintain public access to central bank money. Their survey shows that just under half of the world's central banks are investigating the public's use of cash, and a third are concerned that access to cash could decline in the medium term. And this corroborates other studies that show cash in circulation is increasing, but that much of this is in high denomination notes used as a store of value rather than a means of payment. Now, the rise of digital alternatives to cash have implications for financial inclusion. To highlight this, it's worth reflecting on a 2019 report by New York City's Department of Consumer and Worker Protection that found 11% of households in the city have no bank account, while about 22% of households were underbanked, meaning that they used alternatives to bank accounts for some payments. And in response, New York City Council voted to ban cashless businesses in what politicians said was an effort to rein in the excesses of the digital economy and stop discrimination against low-income residents. The City Council last Thursday almost unanimously passed legislation which will fine retail outlets, including stores and restaurants, if they refuse to accept cash payments. As The Guardian put it, Supporters of the ban argue that electronic-only payments discriminate against low-income people, undocumented migrants, and people of colour who are less likely to have a bank account or access to credit. And if the bill is approved by the mayor, Bill de Blasio, New York City would become the latest place to ban businesses from only accepting payments by debit or credit. New Jersey, Philadelphia, and San Francisco brought in their own bans on cashless businesses in 2019. In Australia, data from My Household Surveys suggests that the unbanked or underbanked are also rising, creating a digital payment divide. So I read with interest a recent speech from Christina Siegel-Knowles, who's the Executive Director, Financial Market Infrastructure Directorate at the Bank of England, who spoke about responding to leaps in payments from unbundling to stablecoins. She discussed innovation in payments, arguing that it could bring significant benefits for users. Innovation could meet unfulfilled customers' needs, widen access to financial services, lower costs, and facilitate better integration of payments with other platforms. And innovation could also support financial stability by increasing diversity in payment methods. Diversity means that if there is a problem with one way to pay, there are already many alternatives, reducing the risk of disruption from any one payment method. People and businesses need to be able to make and receive payments on time with confidence, even in periods of economic uncertainty. She said this is critical to financial stability. While some of the current innovation in payments is very visible, there is also significant innovation happening below the surface. Increasingly, the process of electronic payments has been disintermediated or unbundled. A typical payment chain, which is the set of activities necessary for a payment to be made, may now start with new non-bank entities using new technologies at the point of initiation. For example, the digital wallet provider that lets me pay using my phone to pay with my debit card. New entrants may also be adding an entirely new service, increasing the number of activities and players, and thus lengthening the chain. One example is technology aggregators who provide smaller banks with IT access to payment systems and clearing infrastructure. The current regulatory framework, she said, was designed in a world in which banks and a small number of systemic payment systems made up the entire payments chain. But under the current framework, systemically important payment systems, which is the core infrastructures that undertake the activities of authorizing, clearing, and settlement, and some of their critical providers are regulated in the UK by the Bank of England for financial stability purposes. Combined with the separate financial stability-focused regulation of banks who provide initiation and access, this used to capture the entire payment chain. But today, the banks and payment systems covered by this regulation are only a subset of the entities involved in many payment chains. Indeed, a payment may have evolved as many as four different non-bank entities in addition to my own bank, the retailer's bank, and the payment system, which could be Visa or MasterCard or somebody else. It is possible that over time, one of these new entities will become so critical that disruption to it could take down the entire chain. And if they could disrupt the entire chain, the risks these entities could pose would be comparable to the risks posed by the payment system we currently regulate for financial stability, she said. To safeguard and future-proof our regulatory framework, we need to move away from a system in which how we are regulated depends on the type of entity you are, towards one in which what matters is what risks you pose. In other words, regulation of payments should reflect the financial stability risk rather than the legal form of payment activities. This should cover the entire chain, end to end. Now, this may seem obvious, same risk, same regulation. It's hard to argue that regulation should not reflect risk, and a framework that focused on risks rather than legal form would help level the playing field, ensuring that regulation isn't unfairly applied to one type of firm, but not another, as a result of their legal structure or status. The principle of the same risk, same regulation is technology neutral and could provide clearer expectations to innovators for how they will be treated by regulators when entering the market. But while same risk, same regulation may seem obvious, as payment chains increasingly continue to evolve, new entities, our regulatory framework may require some adjustment to meet this principle, she said. For example, the new global currency proposed by Facebook and partners, Libra, generated headlines across the globe when it was announced last summer. Other proposed private stablecoins continue to emerge. The language some of these proposals use to describe themselves is, well, grand. Libra promises to reinvent money, transform the global economy, so people everywhere can live better lives. In practice, stablecoin arrangements would use crypto assets known as coins or tokens for transactions currently processed by retail or wholesale payment systems. Existing crypto assets, for example Bitcoin, have so far proven too volatile to become widely accepted as payments. Stablecoins propose to address this by using asset backing to establish and maintain a stable value. And it's conceivable, she said, that some stable coins, particularly if integrated into existing online platforms or social media, could achieve widespread adoption very quickly. In India, Google Tez reported having 50 million users 10 months after its launch in September 2017. In China, Alipay and WeChat pay, by some measures, more than $37 trillion in mobile payments in 2018. As such, it will be important to adopt an appropriate regulatory framework for stablecoins in advance of their launch. She said stablecoins poses two unique challenges for regulators. The first is that we need to decide how to regulate them. Proposed use cases for stablecoins vary, and some stablecoins may appear to do more than one currently regulated economic function. But many stablecoin arrangements will facilitate the transfer of money, effectively substituting all or part of existing payment chains. While my ability to pay for coffee with my phone may feel innovative, it still ultimately relies on card payment, a payment method that has existed for well over half a century. Stablecoins could mean that in future, when I tap my phone at a coffee shop, I'll be able to pay with a token that provides a new payment method entirely and which would not rely on either my bank or my credit or debit card. If stablecoins were substituted for existing payment chains, it follows that they could also pose the same financial stability risks as existing payment chains. Failure to regulate them accordingly could leave a stablecoin-shaped hole in our payments regulation. So she said the Financial Policy Committee of the Bank of England has judged that payment chains that use stablecoins should be regulated to standards equivalent to those applied to traditional payment chains. In other words, if you're used for payments, you should be regulated to the same standards as other entities conducting payment activities. It doesn't matter what technology you're using, same risk, same regulation. The second challenge for regulators is that stablecoins differ from existing payment systems in one fundamental way. Regulation of existing payment chains largely focuses on the resilience of arrangements to transfer money, how money gets from point A to point B. However, the reliability of those chains also crucially depend on the stability of the money they transfer. Existing payment systems transfer money that has been created by other entities, central banks or commercial banks. Stable coins propose to create the digital tokens or coins they transfer. Existing payment systems effectively outsource this issue. They only transfer money that is subject to separate protections and regulations to help maintain stability and confidence. The value of central bank money, which gives holders a claim on the state, is protected by the Bank of England's monetary stability mandate and inflation targeting regime, while the value of commercial bank money is protected by legal rights that ensure holders can redeem this money one for one in the currency they deposited. Robust prudential regulation and deposit insurance, in turn, ensures that commercial banks can make good on this in all but rare circumstances. These protections are important as they underpin confidence in the system. These protections mean that the coffee shop where I tapped my mobile phone this morning does not need to worry that the value of my payment will change materially vis-a-vis the sterling-denominated price of the coffee by the time it reaches the shop's bank account. And when the payment arrives in the coffee shop's account, the shop has a clear right to withdraw those funds in sterling and receive the same amount as was deposited. They also mean that, as a payments regulator, I don't currently need to worry about large fluctuations in the money flowing through UK payment systems. I can rely on the bank's monetary policy and regulatory areas to do their jobs. But absent additional regulation, stablecoins may not offer these protections. Regulation of stablecoins will therefore need to be broader than the regulation of current payment chains. At minimum, where stablecoins are used in systemic payment chains as money-like instruments, they should meet standards of stability and protection of holders' rights equivalent to those expected of commercial bank money. Now, she said it's tempting to view questions about the stability of value of the money flowing through payment systems as a new issue, but in fact, it is one of the oldest issues in economics. Indeed, 15th century China's leap backwards in payments was motivated by precisely this issue. Paper money was invented in China as early as the 10th century. Merchants seeking to avoid carrying around heavy iron coins began issuing IOUs written on mulberry bark. The state eventually took over, outlawing private IOUs and banning counterfeit, and the first state-backed currency was born. When Marco Polo arrived in the mid-13th century, he was so amazed by this invention that he devoted an entire chapter of The Marvels of the World to Kublai Khan's tree bark money. But the first big leap forward in payments ultimately ended in the leap backwards. By the mid-15th century, China had eliminated paper money entirely. The state had issued too much money, and counterfeit was rife. Ultimately, mismanagement of the new invention resulted in what was perhaps the world's first hyperinflation. China didn't adopt paper money again for several hundred years, and although paper money eventually made a comeback, it took generations. So my point is, the decisions we take now will have a profound impact on the future. And on one hand, we need to ensure cash is widely available to support payments as digital alternatives, while alluring, are fraught with issues. I think offering more choice is good, but taking away our rights to pay as we please is not. And note that some 10% of central banks surveyed by the BIS are likely to issue a central bank digital currency for the general public in the short term, representing 20% of the world's population. These will be a digital version of existing controlled currencies, not a version of Bitcoin or Libra. But I'd also make the point that in Australia, where we have our new payment platform, which is a platform owned by the major banks and the Reserve Bank, we are already being pulled into a more centralized payment system where transactions can be tracked, where information around those transactions can be reported and recorded, and where the facilities are being built in a way that could ultimately shift us away from cash. But I come back to my main point. To me, freedom to use cash is an ultimate human right, and we should resist anything that might take that right away or modify it negatively. And of course, the current discussion about restricting cash transactions is a great example of restricting our rights and should be resisted. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.